And this is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we're bringing you an hour-long special report about a murder that shocked the state of Maine 16 years ago and the growing number of people who believe that the wrong person's in jail for the crime. In 1988, a 12-year-old girl was abducted from a home in Bowdoin where she was babysitting. Her body was later found in the woods nearby. Sarah Cherry had been sexually assaulted, murdered, and left in the woods. While the search for Sarah was underway, local farmer Dennis DeShane came out of the woods nearby. He had, by his own admission, been doing drugs. He believes they were amphetamines. When he emerged from the woods, he asked the first people that he saw to help him find his truck. He couldn't remember exactly where he had left it. Later, documents from his truck that had Dennis's name on them were found in the driveway of the home where Sarah Cherry had been abducted from. When DeShane was being questioned by the police, he lied about having his truck keys on him and attempted to hide them in the police car. When Sarah Cherry's body was recovered, the police said the rope she was bound with matched the rope from Dennis DeShane's truck. And based on what you've heard so far, do you think Dennis DeShane is guilty? One of our guests today, former ATF agent Jim Moore, did. But after conducting an independent investigation of the case, he was so sure that DeShane was wrongly convicted that he wrote a book about the case titled Human Sacrifice. We're joined today by Jim Moore here in the studio. We're also joined by phone by Carol Waltman, a lifelong friend of Dennis's, who also does not believe that the man she knows could be capable of such a heinous crime. And Bill Bunting is joining us here in the studio. Bill Bunting watched the DeShane trial years ago with interest and thought that the trial was unfair. After that, he spoke with people who knew staff in the jail where Dennis was jailed and who believed that Dennis was innocent. He investigated further, talked to people who knew Dennis, and eventually became a member of the group Trial and Error Dennis. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to be here, Amy.
And Jim, we're going to start with you. Jim Moore, you in 1992 saw an announcement in a local newspaper. You're a retired ATF agent. You're reading the newspaper, and you see an announcement about a group of people that are going to have a meeting in a local church hall and talk about Dennis's case. And they promised in the announcement that they would be able to convince people that Dennis was innocent. You went, but you were skeptical.
Oh, I was more than skeptical. I figured this was a bunch of nitwits going to trash law enforcement. And so I went and figured I was retired. I figured I'll go listen to what these clowns have to say. And I did listen to them, and I came away not believing that Dennis was innocent, but I believed that they were not nitwits. They were sincere people who had reasons for their beliefs. They saw things in the police investigation they thought were improper. So I introduced myself, and I said, I'll look into it if you want. But if I find more evidence of his guilt, I'll give it to the police. And they said, okay. And I went and I talked to his lawyer, and he said, fine. I went up to the prison, visited Dennis DeShane.
Jim?
Okay, we seem to be back on the air. Carol, your voice just indicated that we're back on the air. If you're just joining us, this is a Radioactive special about the Dennis DeShane case. Author Jim Moore, retired Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agent, was just describing how he went with a sense of skepticism to a meeting of a group of supporters of Dennis DeShane, and after hearing what they had to say, decided to launch his own independent investigation into the case.
And I did that fully confident that I would find out. I would answer all their little questions, and I would come back to them and say, you know, very sorry, but your friend did it, and you'll just have to accept that because all your questions have no merit. Unfortunately for that thought, what happened was I found that their questions did have merit. I found that the evidence indicated, well, that Dennis DeShane couldn't possibly have committed the crime, and that's based on the state's scientific evidence, which they obscured and concealed at the trial. And you don't hide something unless it's going to hurt your case. Okay. They concealed it before the trial, they obscured it during the trial, and they suppressed it after the trial.
There are a lot of different pieces of evidence, and we will get into as many of them as we can today, and we'll also take questions later on. But there's one particular piece of evidence that you believe just makes it impossible that Dennis committed the crime.
Right.
Can you say what that is?
Sure, the time of death. The state's medical examiner stated that when he examined the body, the little girl had been dead for 30 to 36 hours based on the fact that he observed the rigor mortis was still present but passing off. And I don't know if you know much about rigor mortis, but it's the stiffening of the body, and it starts in the head and neck and shoulders, and it goes down through the body, and after a while it dissipates. It comes off in the same order. So I'm wondering, you know, well, could this guy know what he's talking about, being a skeptic that I am? And I consulted other forensic pathologists, and I got all the best textbooks on forensic pathology. And what they said was that the longest rigor mortis is going to last is 36 hours. Nobody at the trial ever did the math, possibly because the prosecutor never told the jury when the medical examiner saw the rigor mortis passing off. So they couldn't measure back 36 hours because they didn't know when to measure back from. And then during the, that was before the trial, they had submitted an autopsy report, and they were required to give it to the defense as part of the discovery process. And the autopsy report said nothing about time of death in the body of it. On the cover sheet, there's a question that specifically asks the medical examiner to answer date and time of death. And instead of writing in the date and time of death, he wrote in found July 8th. Well, that wasn't an answer to the question. So they hid it before the trial. They obscured it during the trial. And then after the trial, I got curious about this, and I went up to the medical examiner's office. And I said, I'd like to see, this is 4 years after the conviction. And I said, I'd like to see the autopsy report on Sarah Cherry. And the clerk, or Mrs. Hickey, said, well, I'll have to ask the attorney general's office. I said, fine, go ask him. So she goes to the far end of the room, uses the phone, come back and says, Mr. LaRochelle said, and Mr. LaRochelle at that time was the deputy attorney general, Mr. LaRochelle said, show you what we gave Connolly, who was a defense attorney, and nothing else. Under the law, there's not supposed to be anything else. They were supposed to have shown everything to Connolly.
So they withheld some evidence from Dennis's.
They must have. It's never been found.
At the time.
Oh, yeah, they withheld it. But, yeah, absolutely. And science is something that there's two scientific aspects to this case. There's the time of death and there's the DNA. I'm a great believer in science. You know, witnesses are great, usually. Sometimes they're not so great. They think they hear things they didn't hear or saw things they didn't see. Some of them even lie. Circumstantial evidence is wonderful if you interpret it correctly. Somebody walks into the room here now and his head's wet. Does that mean it's raining out or did he just take a shower? Depends on how you interpret it. So scientific evidence is always good because science doesn't care who wins or loses. Science has no axe to grind. And now the opposition will tell you, oh, there are variables that can affect the duration of rigor mortis. Okay, there are variables. There are three. In this case, it could have affected the duration of rigor mortis, how long it took to come on and pass off. One of them is the ambient temperature, that is, if it's hot out or cold. If it's hot out, as it was this week, it was a 90-degree heat wave going on.
This happened in July of 1988.
Right. And if it's hot, then the rigor mortis comes on and passes off more quickly. If the victim is very young and very old, the rigor mortis comes on and passes off more quickly. And if the victim dies in a state of terror or stress, the rigor mortis comes on and passes off more quickly. And if it does that, then the duration of rigor mortis is shorter. So if you measure back a shorter time from 2 o'clock Friday afternoon when the medical examiner saw the rigor mortis still present, if you measure back a shorter time from Friday afternoon, you get later in chronology, in time. So it's even later. But take the medical examiner, state medical examiner's opinion, 36 hours, and assume that that's correct, that the variables never affected it. That puts it 5.5 hours after Duchesne was in the presence of the state's witnesses and the police. And in most cases, I've noticed, if you're with the police, that's a pretty good alibi.
So regardless of how you look at that evidence about the rigor mortis, whichever estimate you use, Dennis Duchesne was in police custody being questioned at the time. The body had not yet been found. Sarah was, in your estimation, Sarah Cherry had not yet been murdered.
Right.
She was missing, but she had not yet been murdered by the time Dennis Duchesne was being questioned by the police.
Well, it's not my opinion. It's their medical examiner's opinion.
Okay.
And of course, now the prosecutors say, well, there are variables. I say, okay, name one. Name one that would have made the time of death earlier. They never do.
Okay. And DNA, from the beginning, Dennis DeShane was asking for DNA testing.
How many killers do you know that will ask the state, if they're guilty, will ask the state to do the DNA test because the results would kill them?
And DNA, there was some evidence beneath Sarah Cherry's fingernails. For a while, the fingernails seemed to have been forgotten about. But 4 years after the murder, they were initially tested in 1992 for DNA.
The state had defeated the effort to have the DNA tested before the trial.
So the state actually did not want to do DNA testing in
the
murder.
They said it would delay
case.
The trial. And we can't wait for that. As the prosecutor Wright said, the community is anxious for a resolution in this case. We can't be waiting around for.
And also that it was too expensive to get it done.
Oh, it was too expensive.
Right,
that was another
Carol
one.
Waltman, Carol Waltman, Dennis's friend, joining us. Also, I believe in researching and looking at some of the materials around this case, Dennis and supporters did come up with the money offered to pay for the DNA testing themselves, and then were told that in order for the court to allow there to be DNA testing, that they had to prove that the DNA testing would make a difference in a retrial. So basically you had to prove what the results of the DNA testing would be done before the DNA testing would be allowed.
Carol would know more about that back then.
That's something that Dennis actually said in an interview that I saw.
They're claiming now that you have to show that the DNA, that not only that it's not Dennis's DNA in the blood under her fingernails, but you also have to prove that it's the killer's DNA.
So they found DNA. They found Sarah Cherry's DNA, and they found someone else's DNA. When the original testing was done, they knew that the other person's DNA was not Dennis DeShane's, but they did not know who it was. And at the time, science wasn't advanced enough to be able to even determine if it was a male or a female. So for a while, the thought was perhaps it was the child that Sarah was babysitting, or somebody from the crime lab. The state admitted that the crime lab was fairly sloppy. And they hadn't been wearing gloves, and that maybe one of the technicians got DNA underneath Sarah's fingernails somehow. But more recently, there's been more advanced DNA testing that indicates that the DNA does belong to a male, not Dennis.
Right.
So it could not be that of the child or the female medical examiner, and it has narrowed it down to a handful of people. Is that correct?
Well, it was a male medical examiner. The first story that the AG's people came out with was when all we knew was that there were two DNAs, one was Sarah Cherry's and the other one was not Dennis's. At that time, the prosecution's argument was, well, it was the baby she was babysitting, who was a little girl. And then when the tests were done later and proved that it was male DNA, then they, of course, Mr. Stokes, the Deputy Attorney General, says the DNA has no logical connection to the case, and the instruments in the medical examiner's laboratory were unclean, and therefore, maybe it's the DNA of somebody else. And, of course, the first thought is, well, you just gave 40 convicted killers a good argument to get out. Your lab is so sloppy that they don't do it.
It's even been suggested by the state that the DNA is of no significance because Dennis DeShane had no scratches on him.
So... okay, yeah, as we ponder the logic of that. Carol, you're joining us by phone from Aroostook County. Thank you for joining us. And you have known Dennis since childhood and have right from the beginning believed that there's no way that the person that you knew could commit this kind of crime.
That's right. I've known Dennis since I was probably 10, 12 years old. I met him first through my brother. He was a good friend of my brother's, and then... my husband, Jesse, grew up right next door to Dennis, same street and a couple houses apart. So, you know, Dennis was always in the picture, either with my brother or with Jesse. And knowing Dennis growing up, you know, Dennis was such a mild-mannered person, and he was really good in school. And no matter who you were, he accepted you for who you were, whether you had less than he did or a lot more than he did. And just knowing his character, it was just impossible. But then again, I had to think, well, you know, it's a possibility. So, it was kind of scary to even think of that. And, really thinking about it, it was like, well, we'll wait and see a trial here, and they have no evidence against Dennis. I mean, nothing science could connect him, Dennis, to the crime. And I never attended the trial because we were positive that he would be found guilty.
They'd be found guilty?
That he would be found innocent, you know, of this crime. And come to find out, he was found guilty. And that was quite a shock because they had nothing against him. And I think what really, really scared me with this is that, you know, I've got a husband, I've got a son, I've got 10 brothers. And that was a scary thought. If this could happen to Dennis, it could happen to any one of us in my family.
And several of you have mentioned when I've spoken with you before and other members of the group Trial and Error Dennis have spoken about your concerns that if the wrong person's in jail, that somebody very dangerous is still out there on the loose.
Okay, that's
there's
right.
No justice for Sarah Cherry, and somebody may be committing violence against other young girls and have not been caught for that.
That's right. How many children have been abused by this other person, you know, or persons? It's a scary thought. You know, it's very scary. And that's why I got involved 100%, you know. Like I said, I truly believe Dennis was innocent, just knowing his character from childhood. And it was a scary thought. So I started off with a meeting after the trial. Like I said, I never attended trial because we were positive he would be found innocent. And also what really, really got me involved is the state had a witness that testified to the fact that they saw Dennis on July 5 driving up and down the street in his little red pickup. Well, that convinced me that there was a lot of
driving up and down the street in Bowdoin near where
Bowdoin,
Sarah
yeah,
was abducted.
Near where her body was found, and that really hit me up really hard because on July 5, Dennis came to see us. He was here in Madawaska. I saw him July 5th. He bought items from me at a craft fair, and him and Nancy, and they were both in
his wife.
Yeah, and they were both in a, you know, wonderful spirits. They were happy. They were up here for reunions and visiting with family members. And that day, when they left, you know, he took his time down. They took a scenic route down. So there's no way. It takes a good 6-7 hours from here to Bowdoin to get back there. So just that, I thought, I think we're dealing with a overzealous prosecutor here. And it just didn't sound right.
Can you say, Carol, was there anything about Dennis's life at the time that he was arrested that other than the fact he was admittedly had taken the day, something had gone wrong in the morning at work, he'd been working on a project and there'd been some glitch, and so he decided to take the day and get high and go into the woods. Other than that, was there anything in his life? Can you say a little bit about what he was doing at the time? Is there any violence in his history? Had he been in and out of jail a lot? Had he ever been accused of sexually abusing kids or anything like that?
No, Dennis never had anything against him. Like I said, Dennis was a good student. He was way above everybody in high school. His grades were excellent. As far as Nancy, I got to be honest, I met her a few times. I did not know her.
That's his former wife, right?
Yeah, his former wife, right. And it was really hard for Nancy because, you know, she had to deal with this, and she was also dealing with her mom that was dying of cancer. And one of the biggest issues was Dennis did not want her around to stick around because, like he told me one day, he says, I am a prisoner, and I cannot expect my wife to be a prisoner too, because if we stay together, you know, she will be a prisoner. People will look down to her. She's going to have to come here and visit me, and that's not a life for her. He loved her very much. You know, he spoke highly of Nancy, and they were a wonderful couple. You know, she was so much like Dennis.
They were farmers at the time?
Yes, they were. They were farmers, and, you know, they had a wonderful business going. You know, they had it rough at the beginning, you know, like every other business, you know. And but she seemed very happy with Dennis, and they were very much in love.
Carol, I think there's one misconception about Dennis, and I'd have to say this is probably one of the very few bones I would pick with Jim's book, that one might get the impression that Dennis was sort of a happy-go-lucky hippie farmer. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But
right. Good thing, too, because that's a lot of our listening audience.
But in fact, Dennis graduated first in his class.
He was never into trouble in high school,
Yeah, but, I mean, he was a very successful agriculturalist.
That's right.
He graduated first in his class in VTI in Vermont in agricultural economics, and then went on to get his degree in French in Washington State. But anyone who knows Dennis, he's a born agronomist and a very, very able businessman, and he quickly developed a very dynamic business, farming and marketing in Bodenham. I mean, there was an impression given at the time, if you read the press, that he was sort of a drifter, some sort of a Canadian farm worker, as though there was anything wrong with that, but that was the impression that was given. I think when you read, go back and look at the newspapers of that era, it's and also if you listen to some of the tapes on the newscasts, it is shocking. There was a feeding frenzy in the media.
That's right.
And the media still plays a very important role in this tragedy, and they have from the beginning.
And we're going to go ahead, actually, and open up the phone lines to questions as we continue talking about. We're going to go back and have Jim and Carol and Bill talk a little bit more about some of the evidence, because there is so much of that, and some of the irregularities at the trial as well, and what the group trial in Eridanus is asking for. They were in Augusta yesterday presenting petitions asking for an independent investigation. But in the meantime, if anybody has any questions or comments or any ideas that you'd like to share, go ahead and give us a call here. The number is 469-0500, and we'll stop when we get calls, and our panelists here can answer your questions. So back to the trial. You were watching the trial in the news at the time, Bill, right? And there were things that you just weren't making sense to you.
I was just reading the newspapers. I was busy doing other things. I didn't attend any trials. I did not know Dennis, although I knew people who knew Dennis. And I just kept expecting to hear really some damning evidence, and it just didn't come. And when the verdict came down, I think everyone wants to believe that the right person had been convicted. And I would explain it away to myself, saying, well, there must be something that the state knows that they are unable to reveal, but it certainly didn't appear in the newspapers. And it just left me very, very troubled. I think, like a lot of people, I put it behind me, and I certainly hope that the justice had been done. But whenever anything came up about this case in the newspapers, whether it was just a very small little item or whatever, it immediately got my attention. Mm-hmm. And I was always very uneasy about this case. And I recall when a friend was at Union Fair about 11 years ago. He was at the horse pulling ring, and he got talking to the two guards at Thomaston and asked him about this Duchesne fellow. And they said, oh, that guy shouldn't be in here.
The
guards said that, and they were emphatic about that. And then when Jim's book came out, as soon as I heard about it, I went and, matter of fact, I ended up buying a dozen copies, I think. It was absolutely one of the most powerful, unsettling, important books that I've ever read.
And we're talking about the book Human Sacrifice by James Moore.
And my head spun for 2 days after I read that book, and I can't think of another book that's ever had that effect on me. And
it really does outline a lot of the evidence and has photocopies of some of the evidence that was produced at trial. But we start with the papers that were in the driveway of the home where Sarah Cherry was abducted. There
right.
are papers that came from Dennis Duchesne's truck that had his name on them.
Right.
And then the fact that he was in the woods in that town during that day with unaccounted for time. And then also the belief that the rope that was used to tie up Sarah Cherry may have matched the rope that was in the back of Dennis DeShane's truck. From there, the police seem to be, from your account in the book, Human Sacrifice, Jim, and from talking with other members of the group, people seem to think the police were convinced from that point that they had the killer. And do you believe that everything that after that they discounted any evidence to the contrary and just focused on Dennis exclusion?
Yeah, it's obvious in their own reports that they ignored other obvious suspects. I mean, if it wasn't for dealing with the papers and stuff.
Right, right. How do you discount that?
There are a number of things associated with the victim that came out of his truck. The papers that were in the driveway, there's a scarf that she was strangled with, there's a rope she was tied with. The state's theory would have to be that he somehow got her out of his house, drove her 3.2 miles in this truck, and took her into the woods and killed her. Well, the unfortunate part for that theory is that the state lab, Dennis gave them permission to search his truck. So they took it to Augusta, they vacuumed the contents, they swabbed the contents, they microscopically examined everything that they vacuumed out of it. They found no fingerprint, no blood, no fabric from the girl's clothing, not even a hair from her head. And as I understand, the blondes from the hair people, blonde has around 140,000 head hairs, and they lose 60-some a day, naturally, without being kidnapped. They found none of this, no trace of her in the truck. Then they brought the state tracking dog, the police dog, had it sniff Sarah's clothing, put it in the cab of the truck, and it did no hit. So if the laboratory and the dog both say she wasn't there, I believe she wasn't there.
And it's important, Jim, to point out that the jury never heard the evidence about the dog.
That's right. That's right. That was one of the items concealed from the jury at the trial. And I think a lot of people know that if the dog, the state police goes around telling Boy Scouts that these dogs, that the average person sheds 60,000 skin cells a day, and this dog can detect them. Well, but when they can't detect them, they just hide the evidence.
So do you believe that the evidence was planted by the person who was
Absolutely.
Taken from the truck?
It had to be, because to believe Dennis DeShane did it, you'd have to believe he grabbed her, that he transported her in a truck on a hot day, that she was being kidnapped, that papers fell out, he dropped papers at the scene and didn't pick them up and bring them back. They were papers with his name on them, although out of 180 items in the truck, the only two to, quote, fall out had his name on them. Seems a little coincidental. That he transported her up there, that he then dragged her into the woods and killed her, that this master criminal who did all of this without leaving a trace of the victim on himself or a trace of himself on the victim, no hair, no blood, no trace, no forensic trace whatsoever, that this man left his name at the scene and just didn't pick it up, just left it there and walked away. And it was dropped. The papers were found near the front of the tire tracks of whatever vehicle was in there.
The tire tracks weren't actually matched to the...
No, the state expert said that one of the tires on DeShane's truck was consistent with a track in the driveway. And he also said right in his report that track is also consistent with any other tire that has a similar tread design. And the other three tires, of course, weren't matched to anything.
And to use his word, they were excluded.
They were excluded. The other three tires were excluded as having been in that driveway.
So only one of the tires could have been in the...
Apparently he stood up on one wheel and threw the girl into the truck, and the papers fell out when he was putting her in, but nothing fell out when he was taking her out of the truck.
So the one print they do have is a fairly common print from other tires that could have belonged to
other... Yeah, I consulted an expert myself. I got hold of the state... photographs of the state's those tire tracks and took it to a tire expert, and he said there was probably 30,000 tires on main roads that had that tire tread. So I don't think it's very unique, and nobody knows that it's the killer's or abductor's tire anyway.
Okay. Well, what about the fact that Dennis is missing for all of those hours and admittedly doing in the woods doing drugs? Carol, you've known him for a long time. Do you think that there's a possibility that he that under the influence of drugs that he might have done something like this, or
it's said that he was under using amphetamines, and one thing I find really weird about this is Dennis offered his blood that night, a blood sample. They did take blood samples from Dennis, and really strange that they lost it before trial. It was never tested, And from what I've read, what I understand about amphetamines, it's not going to change a person from a mild-mannered person to a killer. You know, it will not change a person's personality. But it did surprise me that he had done that. And, you know, what really, really bothered me is that they lost the blood sample. Did they lose it on purpose, you know, to prove what he was on?
Leaving open the question that he was on something more mind-altering, is that what you mean?
More mind-altering? No, I don't believe that he would have done anything other than that, you know, if it was a speed or whatever it was. I don't think he would have done something else other than that.
Right, but I mean, are you saying that the possibility, do you believe that it may have been lost on purpose so that he can't prove what he was taking?
Of course. It was lost on purpose, like a lot of other things that were never introduced at trial. They made it so that it worked for them, and it worked against Dennis.
Well, what about the people who saw Dennis when he came out of the woods? He saw a couple from the area, and then
Buttrick, later the police.
Did anybody comment that he, on his state
at the time? Said that he was a very nice man, a kind, quiet person.
Carol, I think the word they used was that he acted like a gentleman.
Like a gentleman, right. He helped them with their groceries. They gave him some water to drink because he had been walking for quite a while. And why would he ask them to look for his truck if he had just murdered somebody? He would have known that. I mean, the place was swamped with cops. And from my understanding, from what Dennis told me, is that when he was with the Buttricks, they met up with the state cops and said, hey, let's ask them. Maybe they towed my truck. Why would he want to do that if he would have just murdered somebody? There was nothing on him. No, nothing. No blood, nothing.
But when you consider that the distance between the truck and the body was about 450 feet, Jim, and there was a road running between the two, it's inconceivable to me that Dennis would have gotten lost close to the road and couldn't have found his truck. It just doesn't add up. And no one has ever suggested, to my knowledge, about some drug that would turn an admittedly mild-mannered guy into a predatory psychopath for several hours and hideously torture a little girl, and then just as miraculously turn him back to his normal gentleman. It doesn't add up.
There were some other people in the area who were known to have, or in one case have been accused to have, tortured little girls, to have sexually assaulted little girls. There were pedophiles,
yes.
Convicted pedophiles and accused pedophiles living in the immediate area. How closely were they investigated?
Well, yeah, getting back to your other question about did they focus on Dennis and stay on him at the beginning, yes. If it were not for his papers in the driveway, the first suspect would be the man who had access to that house and knew that Sarah Cherry was there, who was the father of the baby. Now, I'm certainly not saying he was. But they never even checked his alibi for 7 months. Not until February of 89 did they go out and verify his alibi. There was another fellow, a relative by marriage, intermarriage of Sarah Cherry, who was, at that time when she was murdered, he was already under indictment for sexually molesting his stepdaughters. He was never, he gave an alibi, and the police swallowed it, and...
And later,
the victim was
sent to California.
The victim of his molestation was sent to California by the family, and so the charges were dropped. Then there was the third suspect, which I regarded at the time as the most likely. During the search, one of the civilians, there were 200 people out looking for this girl. One of the searchers told the police, well, I found a set of small bare footprints going up this logging road beside a set of large footprints.
And it's known that Sarah was barefoot.
Right. Her sneakers and socks were left back at the house from which she disappeared. So the lead detective, Alfred Hensby from the state police, and his partner, Drake, followed these footprints according to their reports, which are reproduced in the book. They followed these footprints, which led into a trailer named Ficket. That's how they write it in there. Report a trailer, and I call him Barker in the book. I don't identify the suspect, other suspects, because I didn't want to point the finger at anybody. Well, his name has come out now, so it's no secret. So the footprints led into a trailer named Ficket. And at that point, according to Detective Hensby, he turned to his partner and said, we're losing the light. We'll have the wardens check into this tomorrow.
This is 7:30 in the evening on
right.
a July.
Yeah, it's not
evening.
Too dark. So The very odd thing is that 6 days earlier, Detective Hensby had interviewed another 12-year-old girl who was sexually abused by Jason Fickett. And he had also interviewed Jason Fickett within a few weeks before that about the sexual abuse. Fickett was a known pedophile. And yet, and they knocked on every other door in that area looking for witnesses. This seems to be the only door in the area they didn't knock on. Now, Hensby says, well, I didn't know it was the same Fickett. And I'm thinking, Hensby, if the name on the door had been George Washington, I'd have knocked.
So the evening that they're looking for Sarah Cherry, they find an adult set of footprints and a child set of footprints leading into this place.
Half a mile from where she was abducted.
And decide not to investigate until the first.
The wardens will look into it tomorrow.
It should be said that his DNA does not match, has been ruled out as a match because he's since been convicted of other.
I haven't seen the evidence of that. I've heard a prosecutor say in one spot that we have Fickett's DNA, and then in another spot, Fickett's not the man.
Okay, he has
didn't
been.
Say, he did not say the specifically that the easiest thing to say, if that's the case, Fickett's DNA ruled him out. He doesn't say that.
Okay, and he has been convicted since then of other sex
crimes. Fickett, he's been convicted of sex with a 12-year-old, sex with an 11-year-old, sex by compulsion with a woman over the age, and he's currently wanted. He's a wanted man, a fugitive on charges of having sex with a 14-year-old girl. This guy is a little odd.
So there
to say the least.
Were other suspects in the area that weren't investigated.
Well,
at
no,
all.
They just absolutely paid no attention to them.
Okay. I asked Deputy Attorney General Bill Stoats about this whole incident, and he assured me that Al Hensby must have had some reason to know that those weren't Sarah's footprints. So perhaps that's as close as we'll get to a state.
You know, that's a really. It's Carol, really scary knowing that they knocked at, you know, they went to this door and never knocked. You know, Sarah could still be alive today if they would have done that, you know. It's really mind-boggling to think that, you know, and how they failed at not even knocking at that door. Seems to me I would have torn that door down, like Jim was saying, you know, if bare footprints going to that door. I would have torn the door down to look for that child.
Well, back when I was an agent, we used to call things like that a clue.
Well, we still have just a few minutes if anybody has any questions, if you'd like to call in and ask any questions about this case or state your opinion about it. The number is 469-0500. Give us a call. The group Trial and Error Dennis, and they have a website, trialandeurordennis.org. Have been working to try to get a new trial and a new investigation for Dennis. Recently, a panel was appointed to reopen investigation. Let's see, was that November, I believed, or October, the Attorney General named a retired federal magistrate judge and two lawyers to review allegations of misconduct by prosecutors. However, the Trial and Error Dennis has, the group has obtained over 5,000, 6,000 now?
6,000.
On petitions of people who feel that may not be strong enough and they want to go a step further in encouraging an independent investigation. And yesterday they brought some of those petitions to the State House. What exactly are you calling for and why, Bill Bunting?
Actually, the idea for this petition and the investigation came from former Republican Congressman Stan Tupper of Boothbay Harbor. And it goes back to an earlier case in Maine, started in the 1930s. It was resolved with an investigation in the 1950s, and it turned out the wrong guy was in jail. And basically, we're asking for a complete and fair investigation of this case. We're very appreciative of Attorney General Roe's efforts in this regard, as far as they go. But there are many questions about this review. It wasn't titled an investigation. It's a review of actions of the Attorney General's Department. And obviously, there's a lot more that goes into this case than just that. And there are questions as to what direction the commission may decide to go. And I could just point out one possibility. There were two hairs that were found on Sarah, but that were never identified. There was also the rape kit that was in the evidence, and the Attorney General's office ordered their incineration after an appeal had been filed. Now, at that time, it was legal, and it would not be legal today.
Who was the Attorney General at the time?
Fern LaRochelle, the deputy, was the one that ordered the incineration.
And so on the one hand, if the commission is looking to see if the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, well, that they should stamp approval on that action because it was not illegal. But I think many of us would say that a complete investigation would have to look into the reasons for the incineration of that evidence. And so for that reason, that we're continuing our petition drive. And with a slightly different angle, that we can say that all the people that signed this petition do not have confidence in the results of the first trial. And it's not a large step from that to say that they would be, most of them certainly would be in favor of a retrial. And that is what we're now heading towards. Representative Ross Parity has introduced a bill calling for a resolution from the legislature requesting Attorney General Steve Roe back a retrial. And that's our present direction that we're headed.
What evidence would you like to see admitted that wasn't the first time? We've got the DNA evidence.
The DNA evidence, the dog. We've got a good, honest explanation of the time of death and why it was concealed in the beginning.
There was psychological testing done.
Testing that showed that Dennis, according to the state psychologist, the psychiatrist, that Dennis was not in a psychotic state at the time of the crime.
And then the state decided not to use their own
Didn't want that in the trial. Didn't want the jury to hear it. So they objected to it, and the judge agreed with them. And apparently there's a precedent in the main courts that you can use psychiatric evidence to show that you're crazy, but you cannot use it to show you're not crazy. Sounds odd, but there it is.
So his defense attorney also was not allowed to introduce it into trial at all.
Right, and he wasn't allowed to bring in anything about an alternate suspect. The judge outlawed that because he said there's no evidence that there was one, that anybody else was involved. Well, there is now with the DNA.
What about the rumors that he confessed? Is there any way that can you address that and say whether or not that could be brought up at a new trial?
There were two officers who said that he had made what they call confessions, but legally they would be admissions. In other words, he made statements indicating that he might have done it. Deputy Sheriff Detective Westrom of Sagahawk County, who had been a detective at that time for 2 days, testified that Dennis said, "Why did I kill her?" Well, finally, when the legislature pried open the Attorney General's file, which is just, a year ago, we got to see Detective Westrom's notes. And we see that he wrote in the notes, "How could I kill her?" with the word I underlined. How could I kill her? Then he had gone back afterwards, crossed out "how could," wrote above it, "why did." So that he testified in court that Dennis said, "Why did I kill her?" Except, as an English teacher pointed out to us just recently, it doesn't make sense with the I underlined. You can say, "How could I kill her?" But you don't say, "Why did I kill her?"
Right. And these are documents that actually some of them were found in somebody's, stored in someone's barn?
Oh, well, that was Detective Hensby's notes. Detective Hensby testified that Dennis said, "It must have been somebody inside me that did this." And the prosecutor, Wright, said, "Read from your notes." Well, we've now got his notes. And his notes record Dennis saying things like, "I'm not the kind of person that would do that. I wouldn't do a thing like that." There's nothing in the notes about it must be somebody inside me doing this. Now, it seems really odd to me as an investigator that the detective would write down the things that help Duchesne, but would not write down the things that help his case.
And can one of you speak to the issue of Dennis Duchesne's first lawyer, someone that had been recommended by a friend of his wife, who it turns out it had quite a checkered past legally and ethically, and the speculation that he said something to the police that led the police to believe that his client was guilty?
Yeah, according to Fern LaRochelle, who was a deputy attorney general, he called up this lawyer named Carlton, George Carlton, and said, asked him, "Is the girl dead? Are we looking in the right place?" And according to him, Carlton said something to the effect that she was already dead and they were looking in the right area. Now, why anybody would believe George Carlton, I don't know. Why
and this is Dennis Duchesne's, actually, his defense lawyer
who's saying this to the police. During that first few days, yeah. Allegedly. Why would anybody believe a lawyer who's betraying a client? Why would anybody believe a convicted felon, which George Carlton was a convicted felon and had been a fugitive for 7 years when he ran off to Australia and then he came back and served his time and got his law license back? Why would anybody believe a guy who, of all the cases he represented defendants in 1988, and I looked them all up, won only one? He lost every case that was except one. And in that one, his client had refused to give the police a statement and had turned down Carlton's advice to plead guilty, and he got off. And that's the only victory Carlton had that year. So he's a loser. When I talked to him, he was drunk in the early morning.
And he's no longer alive.
Right? He's dead, yeah. Okay, and I'm sorry to not
be dead guy. We can't have him want to defend himself.
If he'd have stayed around alive, I'd still be saying the same thing. I've got him on tape saying, well, DeShane said he couldn't remember, and when they say they can't remember, that means they did it.
Mm. Well, we are just about out of time, so I'd like to just have each of you take a couple minutes and say your last thoughts and what you'd like people to know about this case, and you just take a couple minutes each and do that, and then we'll give people information or give people contact information so they can find out more if they're interested. So, Carol, do you want to go first? This is Carol Waltman, Dennis DeShane's longtime friend.
Sure. I really think the people of Maine should back this up because this can happen to them. It's what was done to Dennis and the case itself is unbelievable. This is not how the system should be. And another thing I'd like to add is that every time something comes up for trial and error or with Dennis, we do think about the Cherry family. It's really mind-bothering that they have to deal with this every day. And we're really sorry about that, but we feel that it's the state that has caused this, all this pain and this hurt for them. I just think everybody should back up a new trial because this could be you. And what would you do if this would be you? You know?
Right. Okay. Thank you, Carol. Do you want to say something? Bill Bunting from Trial and Error, Dennis.
Sure. The main conviction I came away from reading Jim's book, Human Sacrifice, which is a book that, as I say, I think it's of tremendous importance to all of us, was that Dennis had not gotten a fair trial. And that in itself was enough for me to want to work on this case. I couldn't say I was convinced either way that he'd done it or not. I'm not a scientist, and clearly the time of death is the key to this case. There's no way that Dennis could have done it, unless, of course, he'd killed her before he came out of the woods. And the time of death all indicated that was impossible. And I consulted with a pathologist, a retired medical examiner, and had him meet with Jim and go over all the state's evidence, and he gave Jim an A-plus on his interpretation of time of death. And from that point on, I it's a step-by-step process. And I'm at the point spent a great many hours with Dennis, gotten to know Dennis very well, and it is absolutely inconceivable to me that Dennis is guilty, and this is a terrible injustice that's been done. The state, in effect, I'm sure that not intentionally, but has ended up protecting a psychopath who's still out there and is in the process of ruining the life of an innocent and good man in prison. And this is an issue that one cannot stay uninvolved from.
And Dennis DeShane is in jail for life, which, as you point out, Jim, means in Maine means you're there for life. You don't get any early
until you're dead.
Parole.
Yeah.
So he's been there 16 years.
Right.
Okay. Jim, go
well,
ahead. Jim,
I just don't understand who could be against a trial where the jury hears all the evidence, because that didn't happen the first time around. We've proved that by the state's documents, the state's own evidence. So who's against this? Why is the state against it? I mean, they hid evidence the first time. Why are they afraid to have a jury hear all the evidence? There's a reason for that nobody's told us yet.
And what do you think, is there something that if people are interested that they can do to get more information?
Absolutely.
Or
they can go to the website, which is, as you said, trialanderrordennis.org.
Or if you just Google Dennis DeShane.
Yeah.
Can you spell that?
DeShaine. And Dennis with two N's. And That would put you onto our website, which has been set up by Morrison Bonpass, who has done a terrific job on the website and in many other phases of our movement. And we can't thank Morrison enough.
That's true.
And it's, I think anyone going to the website, be prepared to spend a week going through it. There's it's a tremendous website. You can read on for hours and hours. And I urge everyone to do that and then to take this business seriously. And we can certainly use contributions. This is strictly a hand-to-mouth operation, and we have expenses. We have a private investigator. We have a very fine lawyer who is taking only a token, Michaela Murphy, who is accepting only a token of her normal rates for this. And we very much need your assistance.
We have the Innocence Project helping us out.
Indeed, Dennis is one of the first people that the Innocence Project took on. And since taking on Dennis, they've freed over 150 people.
And I believe that's InnocenceProject.org for more information about that as well. So thank you, Jim Moore, author of Human Sacrifice, Carol Waltman, and Bill Bunting, all
thank
of
you,
the group.
Amy.
Thank you, of TrialAndError.org for joining us today. This has been a Radioactive special. Please join us also at our regular time at 4 o'clock. I'd like to thank Joel Mann for engineering today's program and Mark Dyer for graciously giving up an hour of his music program to let us bring you this special program. Mark's up next, so stay tuned to your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, and 102.9 Bangor. Thank you.